And this is our final hour with our special guest, former Defense Secretary of the United States, William Cohen, his book, Final Strike. We're going to take your calls this hour with him as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, William Cohen with us, Final Strike. William, if President Trump called you and said, William, I really could use you for my cabinet, would you consider it?
I'm hesitating because I would say I would, obviously, if the President of the United States ever called you to ask you to serve the country, you don't turn that down easily. I would say that if I were in a position to have the authority to carry out the mission of that cabinet position, the answer would be yes. But if I were if I had to serve a president who did not either appreciate my advice or follow it, then the answer would be no. I would have difficulty, I think, in the current circumstances where President Trump is demanding a kind of loyalty to him personally. Every president, every head of a corporation wants people who are loyal to him, but not to the point where it excludes everything else. And so I would have some difficulty in terms of if the president said you have total autonomy, your recommendation would be given absolute full faith by me. And under those circumstances, it would be very hard to turn down an opportunity to serve the United States again.
Fascinating.
I would have to have that kind of condition to be able to pick my own people mm-hmm. as such, to hire my own deputy, to really run that cabinet as a manager. I would have to have that kind of authority. If I didn't, I wouldn't be doing the president a service, and I wouldn't feel that I could carry out the mission.
You were in elected office for 24 years plus. What got you in the first place to run for office?
Well, it's a long story. I originally wanted to be a professional basketball player coming
really?
Out of college. That didn't work out so well.
What team would you have played for?
Oh, I would have played, if I could have, for the Boston Celtics.
I'd love it.
Yeah, I played an exhibition game. I was a substitute for Casey Jones going way back, but that was the one exhibition game I played in. But I played a lot in college, and so I thought, well, with the new ABA rules that were coming into effect, we had the three-point rule was just coming into play. And, of course, when I played in college, that's where I shot from beyond the 20 to 25 feet. And so that didn't quite work out for me, so I ended up going to law school when I went back to my hometown. And I found that in order to advertise your skills as a young lawyer, you had to volunteer for a number of public functions. And so I started volunteering in order to raise my profile. We couldn't advertise in those days, which was a good rule, I thought. It was unethical to advertise, so you advertise your talents by committing yourself to some public service. And so I got involved as a city councilor, became a mayor, and then eventually ran for the United States Congress. And I ran for Congress by walking. And I walked all the way from the border of New Hampshire all the way to Canada.
And, you're that guy, yeah.
Yeah, it allowed me to come into contact with people in their homes. I stayed with in the homes of people, picked at random, along a 650-mile route. And it brought me to be a better representative of the people, understanding what their daily chores and challenges were, what their aspirations were, what they wanted from me as a public servant. And it was just a wonderful opportunity. So the walk kind of made me and allowed me to become a young congressman. And from there, I ran for the Senate. And I had no desire. I had no aspiration of becoming a Secretary of Defense when I first went to Congress. I thought I'd be there for a very limited period of time. And it's amazing how things unfold. For example, John McCain is one of my closest friends. He asked me to be the best man at his wedding so many years ago. And if you look in the novels that I've written, John McCain really is a part of the character of Sean Falcone. And I've tried to take his experience and what he went through and put it into the character, the main character of the novel.
In your book, that's true. I know his daughter, Meghan McCain, quite well, and just
he's
great
remarkable.
Family.
John McCain, he's having some real challenges right now.
He sure
is. I know, and we're all praying for him. But he's a tough guy. And what he went through I guess what really bothered me initially about President Trump saying that he wasn't a hero, it got me to say, wait a minute, this is a guy that spent almost six years in prison, almost every day being beaten. And when he had a chance to leave early, he said, no, I go when my turn comes and not before. And this is at a time when his father was the Pacific commander, lobbing the missiles into Hanoi. And that's one of the reasons they wanted to get him out early, to say perhaps the father will stop shooting at us. And he said no, under no circumstances. So he's a hero to me, and I think to millions of people.
Oh, absolutely. Look, you don't have to agree in people's views, but don't knock their military career when it's been so stellar like John McCain's was. I mean, I spent 9 years in the Navy, William, and I spent a few weeks at the Pentagon. I was a public information officer. Didn't see any action. I retired from the Navy, not with my 20, but in the 91, 2 months before my entire unit got called up to Desert Storm to work with Schwarzkopf. And an experience.
Yeah, he was quite a guy, and I got to know him quite well because he would come and testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee where I served. And frankly, getting back to John McCain, he's really the reason I ended up at the Defense Department. Back in 1978, Senator Baker had called and asked me if I would be willing to make a trip to China to meet with Deng Xiaoping. And it was John McCain was in the Navy liaison officer. He was a captain at that point, but he was in the liaison office for the Senate. And it was John on that trip to China that persuaded me that I had to go on the Armed Services Committee when I was prepared to go on to the Judiciary Committee, the Government Affairs Committee, other committees. But he said, no, you got to come on this one. And he was such a persistent, persuasive force during that entire trip that I said, okay, I'm going to be on Armed Services. And then after 18 years on that committee, President Clinton asked me upon my retirement from public service whether I'd serve in a capacity that is unequaled, I think, in terms of its power and importance. And I can't say enough about President Clinton giving me a chance to serve as Secretary of Defense. There's no experience that quite matches it, and nothing I'll ever be able to do that would in any way approach the satisfaction that I had in that position.
We've taken a little project under our wing based on the work of a couple of fellows, William Forstchen, who wrote a book called One Second After, about protecting the power grid. We've got to get that done, William. I just don't understand why we haven't passed legislation to do that.
We have the whole issue of EMP
that
will destroy the power grid.
Or a solar flare from the sun.
Yes, and we also have man-made intrusions into our our grid. Recent intelligence reveals that the Russians have penetrated into our critical infrastructure, and they now are in a position, at least, to shut down that critical infrastructure at any given moment. So this is something we have to be concerned about, how we protect it, how we detect when it's been intruded upon, and what the potential consequences are for our country.
Why isn't the president jumping all over this?
Well, as you know, the president has been trying to establish a very close relationship with President Putin. And we have to remember that Putin has basically fired digital bullets into the heart of our democracy by trying to influence the elections. He's tried to do it in France. He's tried to do it in Europe. And he certainly has tried to do it in the United States. And that's the unanimous opinion of all of our intelligence agencies. But the president has been reluctant until most recently to even name President Putin as someone that we have to be concerned about in terms of what he's been doing, and not only in Crimea, destabilizing Ukraine, now buzzing our ships that are in open seas, in the Black Sea as well. So he's been very reluctant to criticize him, and that's raised the issue of why. What is it that President Putin either has? What kind of leverage, if any, does he have over President Trump? We don't know the answer.
We don't have that yet.
But it raises the issue of why the reluctance to criticize President Putin when he does something that clearly is wrong according and dangerous according to our intelligence community.
So, one more question before we go to phone calls or lining up here to talk with you. The raid on President Trump's personal lawyer's office, what do you think of that?
Pretty extraordinary, frankly. It's something that's not... It's not easily done. It's not. It's a pretty high bar, from what I'm told, that you'd have to pass to get a judge to sign a warrant.
They're after something. Jeez.
They're after something, and this raises the issue also dealing with President Trump. President Trump has indicated that he's not bound by the law. Well, I went through the impeachment of Richard Nixon when I was a young congressman. I was on the House Judiciary Committee, and President Nixon was not above the rule of law. And neither is any president who occupies that position. It's a public trust. And so I've been concerned about the notion that I'm above the rule of law because I can fire anybody in the Justice Department. They are answerable to me. And therefore, I'm the chief law enforcement officer, and therefore, this rule doesn't apply. I think he's backed away from making statements to that effect. But obviously, Mr. Mueller is highly respected, a veteran Marine, someone who has been our FBI director, someone who is highly regarded for his ethics, and he must have something in terms of having referred that to the Justice Department employees up in New York.
Yeah, there's something. It's much more than giving $130,000 to Stormy Daniels. There's something else there.
And I think we have to be concerned about it. Obviously, it's a serious issue. But no attorney can ever be complicit in the commission of a crime or helping to cover it up.
That's right.
There's no privilege for that. So we'll have to wait and see.
All right, let's take some calls here while this hour just buzzes by. And by the way, the book is now out, is it not?
It is. It is now out.
And it's published by Tor Forge, which happens to be my publisher as well. William Cohen and I share the same editor, Bob Gleason, who is one heck of an editor. I mean, the guy's a genius, William, isn't he?
He really is. You know, in this book, Bob, after I had written it, and he said, well, why don't you give the asteroid a personality? And I said, what? No, you give it, make it.
Make it almost human-like, right?
Yeah, and so I ended up writing some lyrical portions in the book to say, here's what this asteroid might think if it were animate in any way. And so I gave it kind of a mind but and a dead body, but a living mind.
To the phones we go, Bill in Springfield, Massachusetts, to get us started. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I can't believe I'm talking to you. I love your show.
Thank you.
When Art Bell was running the show. And hi to you, Bill. I can't believe you're talking about meteors tonight because I had the most unbelievable experience in 2011 in my front yard. I had a meteor go right over my head, and I don't know if the trajectory brought it close to the earth, but it seemed so close because I could see the meteor so clearly because the flames would rotate around it. It was white in the front. And you could see the pock marks in this thing as it went by. And this happened within a matter of 5 seconds. You know, it was a clear night. And the most astonishing part of it to me was how clearly I could see it. It seemed like it couldn't have been more than a few miles up in the sky. It seemed like it was like maybe a half a mile wide. I don't know. It was hard for me to figure out to judge the size of it. But what I saw was behind it, there were these huge blocks. They were rectangular, but not completely rectangular. They were like oddly shaped rectangular, large and small, right behind it. And as it went by, you could see these blocks kind of rotating and rumbling against the backside of it. Just unbelievable. And as it went through the sky, you know, it just seemed like I'm all of a sudden, and this in 5 seconds, your brain is trying to say.
Oh, they go by very fast.
Yeah, and you're saying to yourself, what if some debris started coming down? So I'm kind of like, I better duck behind a tree, you know, and I was thinking maybe something could come out of the sky.
But I got to tell you, in most cases, the meteorites that people see, the shooting stars as we call them, are no bigger than a grain of sand. And that's what's so remarkable. They give you this spectacular view of the skies when they buzz by. But if an asteroid hits us, it's going to be bigger than a grain of sand. And
as I said, if it's 450 feet, 460 feet, that will kill a city and maybe even a region.
Yes.
If it's a half a mile, if it's 600, if it's a kilometer.
It was what, a 6-kilometer one that took out the dinosaurs?
It was a huge one. And so if you look at the speed at which they come in, 40,000 miles an hour, with that kind of size, it would devastate the planet. It would crack the mantle of the Earth. If it landed at sea, it would go down and crack the mantle there, and then take the center of our Earth and push it up into the atmosphere. It would turn into fireballs coming down, and ultimately as acid rain, because you'd have carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and methane combining into a mushroom all over the planet.
It would blacken the sun for God knows how long, and the tsunami alone, just if it hit in the ocean, would just rip off the shorelines.
And it would send the winds would go up to 600 miles an hour.
The scary part about this, William, is it's not a matter of if. I think it's just when. I mean, it may be a million years from now. Who knows? But
or it could be tomorrow.
But it could be tomorrow. But I think it's going to happen.
Well, that's why I mentioned the most recent asteroid that went by Russia, passed by Russia in 2015. And
1,400 people got injured with that, with the concussion of that thing.
Exactly. And it was only 15 feet. So if you think of something 15 feet can do that kind of damage, imagine what something a mile wide or 2 miles wide could do.
Tom in the Bronx, welcome to the program. Thomas, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to say that I wonder why the United States can't show some more humanity in a lot of different countries instead of shipping arms over there and everything. Why, if they need housing, let's say, in Gaza, why can't they provide, like, big cargo containers where people can at least get in out of the elements and try to manage Gaza a lot better in other war-prone areas?
We're pretty humane, aren't we, as a country, William?
Well, we are, but think about what President Trump has said. It's time for America first now. What does that exactly mean? That you have a conflict taking place between the president and his military advisors. We talked earlier about in Syria. On the one hand, the president saying, let's get out, and the military saying, well, if you get out at this point, you're simply going to have a return of ISIS because you've got to have some kind of a presence there. But more importantly, you've got you go into areas like Syria, which has been devastated. You can't just leave people amidst the rubble. You've got to try to give them power, electricity,
water,
food, water. You've got to at least give them some stability to get themselves back on their feet, so to speak. And that gets back into the humanitarian portion of it. That we spend a lot of time thinking about how we're going to destroy things, but not enough about how we're going to rebuild things. And the caller has raised an excellent point in terms of, can't we do more in terms of helping people rather than simply looking at it from a military point of view? I think we do more than any other country, frankly. I think we are, as you pointed out, George, pretty humane and given to humanitarian causes. But we've got to have a better balance in terms of how we secure our own national interests, at the same time understanding that if you have pockets of the world which they're just thriving poverty and desperation and no hope, that's a threat to our national security, because we can see, for example, with the weather, climate change, it's going to affect our security in the years to come. Mother Nature is not a Democrat.
Or a Republican, you're right. Stay with us. William Cohen, our final segment next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with William Cohen, a former Secretary of Defense, his book, Final Strike. And William, thanks for staying up so late. You're on the East Coast. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Bob Gleason said that you're the best, and he said I would enjoy every minute of it, and I am.
I'm having a great time. Also, with these world events that are just running all over the place, God forbid, but if anything happens, can we call on you for your little expertise on the show?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It's been a long day for me. I've been doing a number of interviews today, so I'm barely conscious at this point of the night.
You're doing great. You're doing great. Your wife is writing a play, has written a play?
She has. Janet Langhart Cohen. You had a caller earlier from Boston, and they may recall Janet from her Boston days. But she wrote a play called Anne and Emmett. It's an imaginary conversation between Anne Frank and Emmett Till. And it's been performed in about 30-odd cities in the United States. It's going to be going to Amsterdam in May, and it'll be the first international part of the tour for it. But the play is introduced by Morgan Freeman as the voiceover in the beginning, but it takes these two teenage martyrs, basically. Everyone knows who Anne Frank is, and her book is The Diary of Anne Frank.
That's right.
It's second only to the Bible in sales. And very not enough people know about Emmett Till.
No, he was the little African-American youth who was 14 years old and lynched, wasn't he?
He was. He actually brutally murdered in Mississippi, a place called Money, Mississippi, for allegedly whistling at a white woman. They took him out to a barn, and they beat him for hours, tortured him, finally shot him in the head, gouged out his eyes, and they dumped him in the Tallahatchie River. And his body was found a couple of days later, and his mother, who was living in Chicago, he had gone down to visit his grandparents. And his mother insisted that his body be returned to Chicago, and they sent it back, but in a sealed coffin. She said, no, it's going to be, give me a hammer, I'm going to open that coffin up. And so she allowed the public to see what had happened to him. And that was really what began, it instigated the modern civil rights movement. That's when Dr. King then started to march in the South, and Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat.
Yep.
On the bus. And Janet, of course, knew Dr. King. She had traveled with him during many of his trips. He wouldn't allow her to march because she was a little bit more militant than he was.
Right. I knew Rosa Parks, by the way, when she moved to Detroit years ago.
And Janet has interviewed her as well. And so she's taken these two people, who are icons, and said, what would they have in common? Would they have any message for people today? And it's really very creative. It played at the Oprah Winfrey Theater at the New African American Museum in Washington last summer. It's down at the Black Film Theater Festival in North Carolina. So it's a great play, and it has a terrific message. And it's going to be a 3-minute video will be on her website in the coming couple of weeks.
Dwight David Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, talked about and warned us about the industrial military complex.
Right.
Did that ever come up while you were the defense secretary? Did you have that to battle with too?
I did not. The budget was far less then than it is now. And we had put a ceiling on, Congress had put a fixed ceiling on what could be spent by the administration, and the amount of money that we were spending then was close to $250 billion going up to $300. And so it never became as much of a controversial issue because of, number one, the size was not as big as it is today. We weren't involved in Iraq at the time. We spent $1 trillion there. And so you have Iraq and $1 trillion in Afghanistan. So you can see that we have been spending money. And, of course, this gets into the military-industrial complex issue again. But, you know, we still are the best force for keeping peace and stability on the planet. And other countries still look to us, and when we're absent, then we know we create a vacuum, and nature doesn't like a vacuum, and other countries try to fill it, and they don't fill it with values that that we share. So it's one of those challenges that we have. How do we balance the need to be secure in a world that is increasingly small, has been miniaturized by technology. I like to think of it, it's, the world's not much bigger than a ball spinning on the finger of science. And so it's spinning faster and faster, and it makes it much more difficult for global leaders to be able to have the time to make the kind of wise decisions that are necessary. And it's a challenge for all of us. I think that we have the finest military in the world. That military keeps us safe.
Yes.
But we have to make sure we balance that out with care for the people who are falling through the cracks, so to speak. Globalization is a big issue. Elitism, a big issue as such on the part of a number of millions of people. So that we have to take care of people at home who have been injured by globalization. Globalization has lifted millions and tens of millions of people up out of poverty, but there are losers as well. And the losers we have to look after, because technology has contributed to the loss of their jobs as well as trade. And we can't just leave them off to the side and say you're on your own. And that's one of the issues that President Trump has really tapped into. The people who felt that they no longer have a future they can look forward to for them or their families. And there's a deep resentment toward, quote, globalists, internationalists. And President Trump has tapped into that feeling of the alienated.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't ignore it. It's a reality, and it's something that we shouldn't ignore. So the question is, how do we best provide for everybody? And that means having a better economy, a bigger economy, because when the pie gets smaller, the intensity of the competition gets even more, it gets greater. So it's a long answer to your question about do we have a military-industrial complex. We have it's the finest aerospace and defense companies in the world. There are other countries who are looking to either buy or steal our technology that's been developed
mm-hmm.
by these major companies. But we have to find some balance as well to say it can't be all military. And we can't always look to the military to solve problems. You don't solve problems at the end of a bomb or a bullet. You really have to deal with the diplomatic issues.
Yes.
That's why earlier in the program we talked about whether or not we're going to fire missiles into Syria. Now, I think that some military response should be part of our response, but only a part of it, whereas we really should be going after Russia and Syria and Iran in their pocketbooks, namely their economies, if they continue to support this kind of atrocious conduct where we have banned the use of chemical weapons since World War I, and now if they're coming back into being used, then the world has to speak out, not just the United States. And that's why the British and the French have joined the U.S., as well as perhaps some of the Middle Eastern countries as well, saying this is not acceptable.
And what have you heard about the apparent poisoning, that they're getting better, of the daughter and the former KGB agent in the United Kingdom?
I really don't know, have any specifics on that, but again, it's a situation where the Russians have perfected the use of poison in the past. We had the poison umbrella that was used in the past by jabbing an individual over in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We had the poison of another Russian in London. And so I think they're pretty brazen about it, and I think that President Putin, being the former KGB operative that he was, is sending a signal to potential defectors or double agents. We'll find you wherever you are, and you're never going to be safe.
Interesting. Joe, Long Island, New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Joe.
Congratulations on the book and also the walk a while back. my first question would be on the asteroids. I have a second question, too. The asteroids, they burn out, but I don't quite understand why some burn out and some don't. And I would speculate, could you speculate, like, say, an asteroid hitting Lake Michigan in the Sahara? Then I was talking to someone today who was about 10 during World War II, and she was saying how blasé the 18-year-olds look on their phones, et cetera, et cetera. And she said they should be in church praying. And they really don't have a sense of impending doom because, say, an 18-year-old now has never really been through something like World War II. And also I was thinking about Dennis Rodman when he would talk in hoops. I know he's friends with Kent, that guy in North Korea, but also he was actually the most popular figure in China for a couple of years when he was on the Chicago Bulls. And I'm wondering if that had something to do with the expanded use of English in China. and how that might be affecting the culture, where they used to have just the red book and everybody wore the same clothes.
Those days have changed.
The most popular figure is Kobe Bryant in China.
They love basketball out there.
They love basketball. And they had quite a basketball player as well playing for Texas for a while. 7'6", as I recall. But no, they love basketball, and all of our athletes are really admired in European and Asian countries.
I think President Trump should take Rodman with him when they go to meet Kim.
Well, he may.
Stranger things have happened.
And let me get back to the issue of why do some burn up. It depends on their size. If it's fairly small, they will burn up in the atmosphere. But if you get one that's a half a mile wide.
Or made out of iron, right?
Or made out of iron. Some are, the center of it is water. That's why I mentioned some of the asteroids contain water, which can be converted into fuel. And that's why they're looking at mining them as well. But no, you're right. It depends on the core of the asteroid, and again, how big it is. And we've had some pretty big ones that we know are out there. We need to find them again before they find us, and build a spacecraft that can move them. We don't have that spacecraft right now. And according to NASA, it would take 5 years to design and build it. But we haven't started that yet.
By the way, I don't agree with Joe's thoughts, William, about our youth. I think our young people are pretty savvy. They know technology. They get news on their smartphones. They may not be as deeply well-read as other lives were, as we were, for example, because of the internet and things. But they're pretty smart. I mean, my granddaughter's 23. She was politically savvy. She was into this election. She knew things. I had to ask her questions that I didn't even know. And they're savvy.
In our days, we had to have the Britannica Encyclopedia or go to the library to look up information. Now you've got it in the palm of your hand.
That's right.
This is what is so dramatic about the world in which we live. You have the entire information available in the palm of your hand. And so the tendency is to get pretty superficial, however, because we have so much information, we tend to skim along the surface and not look underneath, as you and I had to go back and read the histories. Now we just go to Google and say, or Siri and say, give me an answer. But that's one of the challenges they have as well. But to also get back to the young people, they are the buccaneers of the future. They're the people who are eager and willing to go out and try new things. And so I get enthused by the number of young interns I have every summer. When I tend to get a little bit sour on how things are going, I look to these people coming in. They're bright. They're well-traveled, well-read, speak multiple languages.
They sure are.
And it gives me hope to say the younger generation coming up is going to be okay.
We're going to be okay. Let's see if we can squeeze another caller or two in. Byron, first-time caller in Aberdeen, Washington. Hi, Byron. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing tonight, George?
Great, bye.
Thanks for my call.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. William Cohen, you have touched on so many things this evening. I am so impressed.
I've had a good opportunity in all my years to deal with these issues, and I'm the one who feels blessed to have had this great opportunity. Not enough people have the experience, and I just
These are life experiences, the way you're talking. I've got some simple questions and comments to some complex.
Let's get one in, Byron, because the clock's almost got us. Go ahead.
Okay, asteroids. We talked about that earlier. This one just slammed into the ocean out here about 10 miles from my house at Ocean Shores, Washington, about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the big flashlight, and it was kind of cool. It landed about 14 miles off the coastline, but you talked about logging asteroids catching up to them. I can understand that, but trying to get the minerals out of them. Well, the minerals would be easy to find. There's craters all over the moon. If you just dug out the center of those, that'd probably be where
they're everywhere.
Be everywhere on the moon. Oh, I got another good question. Where's the lunar rover at? Because I've got a pretty good.
Oh gosh, they're all over the place. They're primarily, if you would look at the moon, even with a little telescope, and look at the flat regions of the moon, Those lunar rovers are everywhere. And as far as Mars, we've got a couple rovers over there. They're all over the place, too.
Right.
Great technology.
Looking at all the craters, those craters have been caused by asteroids and larger bodies hitting the moon's surface. So most of the experts in the field, and especially our astronauts who've been out in space, they're really concerned about we're not really prepared to deal with this issue and have been in the forefront of trying to alert the American people. My friend John Glenn, I dedicated this book to John Glenn. I served for 18 years with him on three different committees in the Senate.
Great American.
Yeah, great American. But these are the folks who've been out in space saying, get prepared. There's a lot of rocks out there, and some of them are coming at us.
William, God forbid if anything happens, we're going to tap you for your expertise, my friend, okay?
George, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. The name of the book, Final Strike, it's out there, folks. It is a remarkable book. William Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast as we talk about human consciousness with Stephen Schwartz. An amazing couple hours next on Coast to Coast AM.